The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. Today I'll be talking with Brian Switek about his new book, Written in Stone, Evolution, the Fossil Record, and Our Place in Nature. Now, today's show really does have everything. The wonder of scientific discovery, the clash of science versus ideology, the origin of life as we know it. Also, it has Godzilla. So let's start out with some speaking up. I'm here with Darren Naish, UK science writer and paleozoologist. He works mostly on Cretaceous dinosaurs and pterosaurs, but he also messes around with swimming giraffes, fossil marine reptiles, British big cats, and, as he puts it, stuff like that. He's the author of the blog Tetrapod Zoology. Welcome, Darren.
Good evening. Hi there.
So I contacted you to appear on Skeptically Speaking after reading your blog post, The Science of Godzilla. Now, you originally posted that in 2007, and you recently updated it. So, were there startling new developments in large fictional reptile research?
I'm not aware of any stunning new developments that have been made since 2007. The general thinking on writing a blog is, you know, if you think you're going to get more hits, then there's a good reason there for reciting an article. So I thought it was about 3 years is a long time. You know, people that read the article in 2007 probably had forgotten about it or weren't aware of it. So a few minor updates and the addition of a few extra pictures. But no, there weren't really any new ideas. It was just an excuse to remind people what had been said before about the science of Godzilla.
Before we get into the science of this, can you tell us a bit about Godzilla for anybody who has been living under a rock?
Godzilla is the protagonist of a series of movies that began in 1954, obviously with the Japanese original movie. Since then, there have been about 20 Japanese movies, the most recent of which dates, just think, about 2004. They do not follow from one another in a kind of logical sequence. There isn't a logical single timeline. There's all kinds of crazy stuff like time travel and different origins of different Godzilla creatures. And then, of course, in the US, we have the 1998 TriStar movie, which isn't really anything to do with the original Godzilla films and isn't really liked very much by anybody who likes the real Godzilla. So the TriStar Godzilla is known variously as Gino, which stands for Godzilla in name only, or sometimes he's known just as Zilla. That's become his kind of nickname. Obviously, everybody knows and loves Godzilla. He is a gigantic, atomic-powered, dinosaur-like creature, something like 80 to 100 meters tall, somewhere between 20,000 and 60,000 tons in weight, who regularly lays waste to Tokyo in particular. Is partially aquatic because every now and again he emerges from the sea. It's kind of a strange creature, and he doesn't really behave under the normal rules of biology or indeed physics. And this, of course, hasn't stopped people from speculating about his biology and behavior.
Well, that speculation is very interesting. There's far more Godzilla research than I had realized.
There's a huge amount of kind of informed speculation on how Godzilla might function as a living thing. Obviously, virtually all of it is internet-based. A lot of it is just fun and people speculating wildly about what the anatomy of an animal like that might be like if it were to exist, and also on how its internal organs and so on might function. But the point that I tried to bring home in my article is that a little bit of serious science has been done on whether a creature of that size would be, whether it's biologically plausible, how it might hold up under the weight that it's meant to have, and what kind of animal might it be if it is real. And of course, all of this is done tongue-in-cheek, but we often learn interesting things about, you know, speculating about the possibilities of what might be plausible in evolution. And obviously the main conclusions from those speculations are that a creature the size and shape of Godzilla isn't plausible biologically. But to ask that question, you have to look at what we really do know about scaling and how big animals can be before they fall apart, or the mathematics of scaling make them impossible. And obviously you have to have like a firm sort of biological theoretical background.
Well, let's talk about size and structure first. So if Godzilla was real, could he even walk?
Some some people have tried to work out whether a creature the size of Godzilla could even exist. And interesting point, of course, is his weight does fluctuate massively in the various films. As I said, you can find measures in the literature, in the Godzilla literature, from 20,000 tons to 60,000 tons. But then when people have tried to actually calculate his mass by using just simple kind of displacement techniques, just putting Godzilla toys in water and then scaling them up, I think people come up with weights of 4 million tons or something like that. And based on biological structures, we know the strength of bone, we know the strength of cartilage, these kinds of things. It is not possible for a creature of that size to obviously be able to move. Maybe if it's weight is completely buoyed up by water, things might be different. And of course, is it a surprise that Godzilla is at least partially aquatic? But for him to be able to walk around on land, no, that's not going to work. There's loads of other reasons why a creature that size couldn't work either. I mean, it's been argued that the heat generated by its muscles would cause it to explode due to the buildup of internal heat. And Godzilla's meant to be completely impervious to weapons and to fire and to fighting with other monsters and so on, which suggests that his skin is incredibly thick. But if his skin is so thick, well, how is he able to move? Because he needs to be quite supple. And he's certainly very supple and agile when he fights, using all these kind of kung fu moves and stuff. So I don't think we need to take it too seriously as a living animal. And indeed, it was never meant to be taken that seriously, obviously, by the people who created the creature in the first place. It is a man in a rubber suit. We all know that. We all know it is a bit of fun.
But somebody went so far as to discuss the potential blood pressure and circulation issues.
There's a website which does look at not only what I've just mentioned, the stuff about the size and the buildup of heat, but also whether Godzilla would be biologically plausible in terms of circulatory system and so on. And for the projected size of the creature, so you'd have to have a huge heart because you're meant to be pumping blood around the body that's well between 80 and 100 metres tall. Yeah, projected blood pressure would just be insane. And again, the argument is that using kind of the biological structures that we know about, it isn't possible to have blood pressure strong enough to pump blood around the body without at the same time busting blood vessels. So, it just can't work as a living animal. But the kind of argument around that sort of obstacle is, well, if a creature was that size, would it have the same tissues as much smaller creatures? Would it have evolved some novel solution if you wanted to try and invent a plausible fantasy creature and use that kind of argument? Then you can always invoke arguments about imaginary different systems, arteries and veins that are harder than those of much smaller creatures, but it wouldn't work based on the biology of the smaller creatures that we know about, the normal creatures that we know about.
Veering into completely within the realm of cinematic magic, the production of radioactive fire breath was discussed. And you actually cited someone who hypothesized that Godzilla may have a few unique organ systems, a uranium sac.
Right. Yes, there's a large speculative literature. And I use literature in the broadest sense because, of course, yes, a lot of it is only online. You won't find this in peer-reviewed technical journals or anything. But Godzilla is supposed to be kind of like a living nuclear power plant, and it's never really explained exactly how this is meant to work. They're kind of a bit sketchy on it in the movies and in all the surrounding literature. But supposedly Godzilla functions as a nuclear power plant. He's generating nuclear power all the time. And when he shoots out atomic breath when he's fighting other monsters, and when the plates on his back glow, he's discharging atomic energy. It's not really clear how this happens. It's pretty handy, though, because it means he doesn't have to eat. He generates his own power, and if you weigh, 20,000 to 60,000 tons, it's a pretty handy thing. You don't have to eat. You generate your own power. But supposedly, and it's got to be said that some of these explanations are actually incompatible with one another. I think that's because different people are kind of, making up their own little explanations. But it's been said that either his stomach has mutated into some kind of new organ, which has been termed the plasma gland. That's one explanation. The plasma gland is some atomic fuel source, and some of the excess radioactivity that he generates, some of it goes to the plates on his back, so he discharges atomic energy to the plates, and other parts of the energy kind of come up through his throat, and that's how come he can blast out his atomic breath. Other people have said that Godzilla has a couple of nuclear storage sites somewhere in the kind of chest cavity that serve a similar function, and also allow him to not only generate his own atomic power, but also to have atomic breath. And I'm no nuclear physicist, but I'm thinking these ideas aren't really compatible with biology. Again, it's pure pseudoscience fantasy stuff. Yeah, it's fun.
But the plasma gland is impossible, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I don't want to be mean about it. I wouldn't use that word, but I would say it doesn't really match with what we kind of understand about biology. Let's just leave it in the movies and say, oh, isn't it cool? But it wouldn't happen in real life. I think it's all tied in with Godzilla's origin story as well. I mean, there's several different ideas. There's several different themes explored in the movies about how Godzilla has originated, and one of them is that he is some kind of late surviving dinosaur that was in stasis. He was frozen or something, and mutated by radioactivity. So radioactivity has always been a big part of the Godzilla story, and of course that obviously ties in with Japan's cultural history. So that's always been a big part of the story. You can't take radioactivity away from Godzilla, I would say.
So if he was a dinosaur, what kind of dinosaur then would he most resemble?
It's always kind of obvious that Godzilla is kind of based on the predatory dinosaurs, the group of dinosaurs called theropods. And right from the start, right from the original Toho 1954 movie, you would say that Godzilla is kind of a super-sized, super-powered Tyrannosaurus Rex, maybe combined with features of some other dinosaurs, like, for example, Stegosaurus, with those characteristic plates running along the back. Old versions of old images of predatory dinosaurs, of theropod dinosaurs, people imagine that they kind of walked with their tails dragging along the ground, which, you know, we have a lot of reasons now for thinking that really wasn't the case. They would have had a posture kind of more like that of birds. They would have had a sort of horizontal body posture with the tail held well up off the ground. So Godzilla's kind of pseudo-human posture does reflect outdated, incorrect views about dinosaurs. And it's really convenient that his human-like posture means that, you know, he can be portrayed by a person in a suit. But I'm sure that's coincidental, really. But Godzilla is obviously, he is inspired by predatory dinosaurs. And they've written that into the story in some of the more recent movies. It turns out that, according to one idea about Godzilla's origins, he was originally a predatory dinosaur. He was a theropod dinosaur that became mutated by radiation.
So is this a field that's been around for a while then, and I've just missed it? Speculative zoology, is that what I would call it?
The interpretation of Godzilla and those other Japanese movie monsters is a specific little sub-discipline termed kaiju biology. Kaiju is a Japanese word for monster. And it's kind of like fan fiction genre. It's something that people have indulged in since kind of the mid-1990s. There's been this small movement to try and work out what the anatomy and biology of Japanese monsters was like. But you could regard it as part of a larger area that you can call speculative zoology, which incorporates everything from speculating about the anatomy and appearance of possible alien life forms to possible future creatures, and also speculating about the biology of, you know, creatures from fantasy and fiction. And this has just always been a kind of sort of nerd's paradise, you know, a bit of fun that a lot of us indulge in, inventing hypothetical future creatures or trying to work out the anatomy of monsters from, I don't know, the Lord of the Rings movies or the Star Wars films or Star Trek. I think it's always been there. As long as there have been sci-fi fans, there has been speculative zoology, speculative biology.
Well, the nerds, thank you, sir.
I don't know how to respond to that.
Thanks for being here, Darren.
Thank you very much. It was good fun. Thank you.
You can read more of Darren's writing at scienceblogs.com/tetrapodzoology. And Darren's also the author of a number of books. Darren, why don't you list them?
I've just published a book called Tetrapod Zoology Book 1, which is a compilation of blog articles, obviously from Tetrapod Zoology. I've also recently published a children's book called Dinosaurs Life Size. And in 2009, I published a book published by University of California Press called The Great Dinosaur Discoveries.
Perfect. I do suggest other people check those out. I have not. I am about to. And we'll be right back with more Skeptically Speaking after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. You can email your questions for next week's episode to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio, or use our handy question submission box on the website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also subscribe to the show in iTunes or listen to past episodes, and while you're there, why not add your review? Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. Check the media page at skepticallyspeaking.com to see if we air near you. And now, back to the show.
Hello. Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm joined today by science writer Brian Switek. He blogs for Wired Science and the Smithsonian's Dinosaur Tracking, and he's the author of a wonderful new book, Written in Stone, Evolution, the Fossil Record, and Our Place in Nature. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thanks, Desiree. Thanks for having me.
So this book, sir, is very much not a textbook. You're telling stories.
That's right. A lot of people asked me when I first told them about this book project, oh, are you writing a textbook? Are you going to document, you know, everything from the first life 3.5 billion years ago through the modern era? And that just really didn't appeal to me. What really drew me into the fossil record and to paleontology in the first place was hearing these stories about people like O.C. Marsh and Edward Drinker Cope, these paleontologists who had this fossil feud going on in the late 19th century, people like Charles Darwin and Richard Owen and Thomas Henry Huxley, how they came to understand what we basically know about the fossil record form the basis of our ongoing understanding of how life has evolved. So I thought, what better way to introduce people like myself who might not know a whole lot about evolution or paleontology to the subject through the stories of these people and of the life forms that they studied.
Nice choice.
Oh, thank you.
And we often credit Darwin with creating a scientific revolution in his time, but there were other thinkers and naturalists who paved the way for the publication of Natural Selection. So tell us a story about them.
Well, there are a number of stories that I could tell going back to the 17th century. Nicholas Steno, this young anatomist who one day has the opportunity to dissect this great white shark that had been sort of carted all the way from the Italian coast to this anatomical theater. And back then, you know, before, you know, Netflix and Twitter and everything else, this was big entertainment, you know, seeing somebody do a dissection or an anatomical demonstration. And as he sort of peeled back the layers of, you know, the head of this giant fish, he noticed that the teeth in the mouth of this great white shark resembled these sort of odd stones that people would find scattered around the European countryside. And there are multiple explanations for why these would be here. Some people called them tongue stones, these sort of petrified tongues of snakes, or they fell from the moon, you know, on specific nights, or they were sort of the earth itself trying to imitate life. But Steno, like a few people before him who never really got much traction with their ideas, said, no, these really look like the teeth of a shark. These probably belong to sharks that swam, you know, this prehistoric ocean, you know, in this time beyond human memory. And it got him thinking about, okay, well, what does the geology, you know, what do the rocks in the area actually say? You know, how did these teeth get here? If they are really real, like I think they are, how did they get deposited on dry land or get pushed up onto these mountaintops? So he figured either the land had once been covered by water, and the Bible said this happened at least twice during the creation and during the flood. Obviously, we know that's not accurate now, but this was the framework Steno was working with, or the land had been pushed up from underneath the waves. And he recognized that these things were fossils. They're vestiges of ancient life. They weren't just these odd little things that just supernaturally appeared, but you could look at these things as clues to the life of the past. And there was a lot of debate about whether he's actually right or not for a number of decades after his discoveries, but this really set the basis for the beginnings of paleontology.
So people really hadn't ever thought about how old the land was at that time?
It really always seemed apparent that the biblical explanation or some sort of supernatural or religious explanation had been true. There wasn't, I mean, going back to Greek and Roman philosophers, you had different ideas among like the Ionians and other scholars about, you know, whether time is infinite or whether it's limited. But within Steno's sort of Central European framework, the biblical narrative was typically taken as true. There was a, you know, everything appeared more or less as it was very recently, and there wasn't really a whole lot of established thought about what these sort of vestiges might mean, because nobody really recognized them. There's no real reason to sort of question it. Everything, you know, appeared completely in accord with the traditional narrative. But the recognition of fossils was one of the things that caused people to say, hey, wait a second, something, you know, isn't quite right here. The world has changed. It isn't static. And as I just said, that sort of formed the basis of both paleontology and the very first glimmerings of maybe an evolutionary thought, not in terms of life per se, because the sharks of the past would have been the same as sharks now. It's just a matter of timing. But if the Earth itself could change, and if physicists, you know, were finding that there are laws of nature that regulated the motion of the planets and all these other natural laws, then perhaps there was a natural law that regulated change. So there wasn't a direct line from Steno to Darwin, but Steno's work and the work of other naturalists who were finding these fossils really formed the foundation of what would later become evolutionary paleontology.
So what did bridge that gap then, from Steno to Darwin?
Really a lot of debate, people finding a lot of fossils and arguing about them, and recognizing that life had changed, that there was a succession, that forms in the past weren't exactly the same as they are today. The French anatomist Cuvier, who came to prominence in the late 1700s, right before the beginning of the 19th century, he recognized that extinction was a fact. Nobody had really established this before. The idea had been sort of toyed with, but by looking at the bones of Asian elephants, African elephants, woolly mammoths, and the American mastodon, all these elephant-type forms from different places, two living and two fossil, he recognized that they're all distinct from each other. Two of them had lived during the past. They weren't to be found anywhere today. There were forms that lived during the ancient past that were entirely wiped out and you couldn't find anywhere in the modern world. And that itself wasn't evolutionary, but it helped establish the fact that life was different. Life had changed. And Darwin himself, when he went on the voyage of the Beagle to South America, we don't typically think of Darwin as a paleontologist, but he was very interested in geology during that time of his career, and he collected a number of fossils. Many of them were from the relatively recent past, during the Pleistocene era, this time during the past 20,000-30,000 years or so. He was finding the bones of giant ground sloths, these things called glyptodonts that look like giant armadillos, of fossil horses, of things that he thought that looked like fossil llamas. So all these fossils he was finding seemed to be representatives of kinds of animals that he was seeing living on the continent at the time. You had giant ground sloths, and you had sloths living in the trees today. You had giant armadillos in the past, you had armadillos living today. And he even said in the beginning of On the Origin of Species, the very first line of the introduction is him saying that he was first struck to think about evolution by recognizing the succession of forms between the ancient and the modern, that the forms that lived in a particular place in the past were connected to ones that lived during the present but had obviously changed over time. So really, by filling out the fossil record, even though it was very incomplete in terms of what people understood during the 17th, 18th, 19th century, it got naturalists thinking about how life might change according to these natural laws. And it was an overall change as well in terms of the way we thought about nature, that there wasn't a whole lot of supernatural intervention going on, that there were these sort of natural laws that either just occurred or were sort of put in place that regulated the running of things. You didn't have to appeal to this miracle or fiat of divine intervention in order to explain these changes.
Well, Darwin didn't initially believe that species could change. So was there a catalyst of some kind?
Part of it was looking at those fossil animals. It wasn't so much the finches. Everybody thinks of Darwin's finches and because they're the famous evolutionary icon, thanks to that great book by Jonathan Weiner. But like I said, the first line of the introduction of On the Origin of Species is him saying, I went to South America, I saw this correspondence between the forms, and that got me thinking about how species might change. In his notebooks after the fact, he didn't immediately think of natural selection. He was thinking in terms of maybe this massive mutation, maybe one of these extinct armadillos sort of gave birth to something more like a modern armadillo, and these great leaps happen within a short amount of time, within a small number of generations. He later tossed that out. But the correspondence of the fossil animals was one of the things that got him started thinking about this. But during his voyage of the Beagle, he was definitely a creationist of a stripe. During his visit to Australia he wrote about a little antlion, this little sort of larval insect that forms this pit and shoots sand up at ants to get them to fall in and then devours them when they tumble to the bottom. And he had noticed the same organism in Europe, and he, you know, said to himself, or he wrote in his journal, that this was surely a sign that there was one designer who sort of oversaw, you know, the entirety of creation. He wasn't sort of like an Answers in Genesis type young earth creationist that we know of today. That's something relatively modern that came out of the 1920s American fundamentalism. But Darwin was very interested in natural theology. He studied the works of William Paley, who was sort of the guy who established this sort of almost intelligent design type view that if you looked at nature, you could see some aspect of the divine. So that was the framework with which Darwin was working during that voyage, in which he later started to break away from.
Audience, you're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm joined by Brian Switek, author of Written in Stone, Evolution, the Fossil Record, and Our Place in Nature. If you have questions, email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com, tweet us at Skeptical Radio, or use the handy question submission box on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. So you did mention Darwin's finches. So
yes.
Talk a little bit more about that for those who don't know.
Sure. While visiting the Galapagos Islands, Darwin did a lot of collecting. I mean, his sort of background as a naturalist came from sort of shooting and collecting as many insects and birds and other things as he could. That's how he started to make his name amongst the Victorian naturalists back in England, especially through beetles. He was a rabid coleopterist, collecting everything that he could get his hands on. And he did much the same throughout his journey. And he didn't really recognize the significance of the birds he collected. He didn't even really label many of the birds that he collected on the Galapagos Islands. He had to rely on the collections of Captain Fitzroy, who the whole reason Darwin had gone on this trip was because the captain needed a companion to sort of keep him sane. So Darwin was sort of, he wasn't brought on as the ship's naturalist, but he was brought on as sort of the gentleman accompaniment for the captain. And the captain had kept much better notes about the birds that he had collected and where he got them from. So when John Gould, this ornithologist, started looking at these birds back in England, he said, well, wait a second, this isn't just one species of finch. You have multiple species, each sort of unique to their own island. And other naturalists previously had thought about centers of creation, how there might be these particular places where a whole bunch of organisms were brought into existence at one time. But the finches on the islands showed correspondences to each other and correspondences to the finches on the mainland. It didn't make sense that sort of God or a deity would go from island to island creating its own species of finch. Something must have happened to differentiate them from each other. And that was another sort of piece of the puzzle that inspired Darwin to start thinking about how species could be modified.
So what prompted him to actually release his findings then?
Darwin had been working on his ideas for quite a while, you know, over two decades of research. And he'd actually inspired other naturalists. He inspired a young naturalist named Alfred Russel Wallace to go specifically to South America to collect specimens in order to solve the species question, whether species could change or not. So Wallace was of a bit of a different background. Darwin came from an affluent family. He's more or less set for life after he came back from the Beagle journey. He didn't have to worry about anything else. He could just do whatever science he wanted. Wallace was more of a working class scientist in that he always had to be going somewhere, writing essays, collecting specimens to sell. And his journeys eventually brought him, after his trip to South America, also to Indonesia, where he started seeing similar things to what Darwin had seen during his Beagle journey. He started to think about species change there, and he realized he basically came up with the idea of natural selection as well. So you have Darwin, who's sitting on this idea for a while, and he really wants to get a lot of data together, and he wants to create this big book called Natural Selection that he's going to release and really wow all his peers, because he's seen other evolutionary books come out, like a book by Robert Chambers called The Vestiges of the Natural History of Creation that was really controversial, and people just tore it apart both scientifically and theologically. Darwin knew if he didn't have his act together, much the same would probably happen to his book. So he's working. All of a sudden, 1858, he gets this letter from Wallace saying, I know we're working on similar stuff. here's my idea about how evolution might happen. I'd really love your thoughts on it. And Darwin just freaks out. He wrote a ton of letters that afternoon to his allies, Charles Lyell and other friends, saying, like, you know, I'm sunk. I now that I have this, I can't not put it forward. You know, I have to put this out and publish it and let people know about Wallace's work, because if I hold it back, then people sort of hold me suspect. He was very distraught. And eventually his friends said, listen, this is what we're going to do. We're going to present Wallace's essay, which is well-formed and thought out, basically ready for publication. And we're going to take one of your letters and some of the notes that you drew up a while ago, stuff that you thought no one would ever see, and we'll present these things together to show that both of you have been working on this idea, that you didn't copy from each other, there's nothing untoward going on here. And they did this, and the essays were very similar. They differed in some minor points. Darwin thought that artificial selection, this sort of farmyard selection, the breeding of animals, was a good example of how natural selection might work. Wallace thought that wasn't a good comparison at all, and it should just be tossed, because whenever something that had been, you know, a fancy breed returned to the wild, it sort of reverted to its original state. So they differed on that point, but otherwise their ideas were very similar, and the ideas were generally panned by the academic establishment. Natural selection wasn't necessarily a new idea. People had come up with this idea before, and they thought it was either too weak to affect change, that it could keep things the same but not really cause them to evolve, that it might be a destructive force, but, you know, nobody thought it was particularly noteworthy. But since it was out there now, Darwin was spurred to take his big book, Natural Selection, and condense it down to On the Origin of Species, which is basically an abstract of what he was really planning. I think that's one of the reasons that it was successful. The historian Martin Rudwick has argued this point, that part of the reason why On the Origin of Species was so widely read and so successful is because it had to be an abstract, that Darwin had to make it as accessible and as concise as he possibly could. If he had published the book that he envisioned, probably only a small number of specialists would have read it and wouldn't have had the same cultural impact that it did.
So in many ways, nothing's really changed.
In terms of academics and publishing papers,
in terms of making things short enough to read, and also
that
push to publish your findings before someone else does.
Yeah, it's still there. It goes back a long way. I don't know if academics are always as gentlemanly as they used to be in the Victorian era and worry as much about how they might look to others. But it's a lot of the concerns that scientists have today still were present in Darwin's era as well.
So was there, I guess, a main scientific objection to the theory?
A lot of paleontologists objected to it because it wasn't consistent with what they saw in the fossil record. During the time, you had a lot of sort of single species or single genera that seemed to appear out of nowhere. They didn't really change, and then they disappeared. So Darwin's theory predicted that there should be these graded lineages, these graded chains of organisms going back to a common ancestry. The single illustration in On the Origin of Species is a sort of branching evolutionary tree, predicting what we should find, you know, as we looked through the rock layers, and that wasn't found. Richard Owen, who was an evolutionist but disagreed with Darwin about how evolution might have occurred, wrote this anonymous review where he said, you know, look at the ichthyosaur, look at the mammoth, look at the dinosaurs. You know, all these things appear suddenly, they don't change, and then they go extinct. Obviously, Darwin's theory can't hold for the fossil record. And for decades, really, after On the Origin of Species was published, many paleontologists preferred alternate evolutionary mechanisms, you know, major mutations in one generation, or these sort of internal driving forces that were imposed from within, sort of forces inside the bodies of the animals themselves that would push them up the sort of evolutionary ladder towards some kind of ideal. And it took a long time for natural selection to become established as, you know, the main engine of evolutionary change. And that held for other scientists as well, despite the fact that we talk about Darwin so much. We just had the year of Darwin last year. You know, every biological discipline tries to sort of claim him as their own. His ideas weren't really that well received by other scientists. He legitimized the idea of evolution. That's a theory, that's a reality worth considering, and considering how evolution occurred. But many, many naturalists didn't think natural selection was the way that it had happened.
And we have a question from the chat room.
Did scientists or philosophers in non-Western cultures hit on something like natural selection, or did they stick to their myths? And that's from Evil Ray.
I don't know of any from other cultures. Obviously, you had major scientific cultures in the Middle East and also in China and other parts of Asia. Unfortunately, most of the history that's been written about evolutionary science has focused on England, France, Germany, a little bit of the United States, but it's mostly been something that's been understood in Western terms. So I'm not familiar with other ideas of natural selection from elsewhere, but that's something definitely worth looking into.
And we have another question from the chat room.
Did the feud between Marsh and Drinker Cope do more to impede or advance our understanding of paleontology and evolution? And that's from Vitor.
And give us some background on that.
Sure. So during the late 19th century, this is like right after Darwin's book has come out, American paleontology is just sort of getting its feet under it. It doesn't have the long tradition that it has in Europe. You had these two authorities. You had Edward Drinker Cope from Philadelphia and Othniel Charles Marsh, who had his own museum basically created for him at Yale by his rich uncle, Peabody. He basically said, "Uncle, can I have a museum?" His uncle said, "Sure, I'll fund it. You don't have to answer to anybody." And that's how Marsh got his museum. If you go to the Peabody Museum today, that's why it's there. So they started off as friends. They had met in Europe and sort of hit it off. And then once they were back in the States, Cope invited Marsh to see some of the fossil sites in southern New Jersey. And all of a sudden, after that visit, Cope's fossil supply sort of dried up. A lot of times the naturalists wouldn't necessarily go into the field themselves, but they'd tell local miners or other people working there, if you find fossils, I will buy them from you. So Cope got a number of fossils this way, but all of a sudden the supply sort of went dry. Marsh had paid the same people to get the fossils to go straight to him. And there was a bit of a feud over an Elasmosaurus skeleton. Cope had found this long-necked paddle-finned marine reptile, and he ended up putting the head on the wrong end. He put the head on the tail end, and other naturalists, including Marsh, pointed this out, and that began the sort of, that was the beginning of their major fossil feud. And they both continued within the discipline. They were both going out west, the sort of uncharted fossil region where there are lots of new dinosaurs, lots of new mammals, lots of new interesting things to be discovered, but they're in constant competition with each other, and it got to the point where they would basically telegraph back their new findings as soon as they were made. They'd find, a horn core from a horned dinosaur and write back this brief telegraph describing it to get into print first to make sure that their rival did not publish before they did. And the next day they might find, the toe bone of the same kind of dinosaur, but because they don't have the whole skeleton, they're just naming fragments, the number of names just blew up tremendously. But through this, it caused a lot of confusion, but at the same time, it established American paleontology. These were guys who hired a lot of the major fossil collectors that would become the next generation of paleontologists. So it did both. It impeded it to some extent, caused a lot of confusion, but also established American paleontology.
One of the most interesting things about your book is you have an amazing cast of characters. So who was Richard Owen? He's very interesting.
He was an English anatomist. He was sort of the star anatomist of the 19th century. He moved in socially conservative circles, but he had sort of liberal scientific ideas. There's a book that he wrote called On the Nature of Limbs about the correspondences between vertebrate skeletons, how you can look at the arm of a bird, the arm of a crocodile, the arm of a human, the arm of a bat, the arm of a seal, and see the same bones. They had all been adapted to different uses, or I shouldn't say adapted because Owen didn't believe in this sort of adaptation, but they had been all applied to these different uses, but they're built on the same body plan. And towards the end of it, he snuck in some evolutionary language about how we can determine some kind of natural law from these correspondences that would create these different forms from the same ground plan. You start with something that's sort of like a sardine or like a bony tube, and from that you can derive any number of forms through some kind of evolutionary law. And his backers did not like this at all, and the other naturalists at the time were really confused, because Owen sort of clothed this within theological and Christian language to sort of protect himself in a way, or make it seem not as controversial, to tie it directly to some kind of plan from the creator. So basically he alienated some of his friends, and he confused all the naturalists who might have agreed with him otherwise, and he kind of went down in history as this arch-creationist villain who was opposed to everything Darwin ever did, when in fact, they agreed on quite a bit, but Owen was as cantankerous as he was brilliant. He named many fossils. He interpreted many fossils. He, you know, coined the name dinosaur in 1842, and just did a lot of fantastic work. But because of his opposition to evolution by natural selection, he sort of went down in history as this major villain, when in fact that wasn't the case at all. And there's been a bit of rehabilitation to him done in the past few years. There was a book that was just reissued called Richard Owen, Biology Without Darwin by Nicholas Rupke. And for anyone interested in Richard Owen, I'd recommend reading that book, because it really puts him in context of Victorian science. He was interested in building up Victorian science and paleontology by collecting a lot of fantastic specimens like Archaeopteryx and giant sloths and things from South America, and making London, the British Museum of Natural History in particular, now just I think the Natural History Museum, the premier place for paleontology and anatomical science. But his legacy has been somewhat misinterpreted because of his disagreements with Darwin.
And a question from the website.
To precede my question, it must be said that there is a seemingly never-ending supply of excellent archaeological evidence to substantiate what we know about our roots. As with any good science, however, with new knowledge and technologies, scientists have found that some previously held beliefs were wrong. Can you give some examples of the most substantial mistakes, or later discredited assumptions, that earlier scientists had made regarding the fossil evidence, which we now know to be untrue? And that's from Lee in Winnipeg.
Yeah, there are a number of small stories, you know, misinterpretations or misunderstandings involving the fossil record. One of my favorite, I guess, involves the savanna theory of human evolution, this idea that we sort of originated from this chimpanzee-like knuckle-dragging ancestor, and we sort of stood up out on the African plains, you know, sometime during the past few million years. And, you know, the reason for that, you know, has been debated. There have been any number of hypotheses as to why. You know, it might have been looking over the tall grass to see predators first. It might have been for carrying tools or carrying babies or carrying meat back to provision, you know, other members of the social group for sex, or, you know, any number of ideas. But through the discovery of earlier and earlier fossil humans, especially discoveries like Ardipithecus ramidus that was made just, I think, in, 2 years ago, and a few of the other new early fossil humans that were discovered around the beginning of the 21st century, we're beginning to see that a lot of the traits that we thought were distinctively human, like the ability to stand up bipedally, you know, walk upright, evolved as a result of sort of evolutionary accidents, that life in the trees sort of was co-opted for life on the ground, that these apes had a kind of anatomy that when they walked on the ground allowed them to stand up, which was easier than sort of walking on their knuckles like chimpanzees or gorillas do. This is still being debated and discussed as well. But there used to be this sort of evolutionary narrative of the sort of ascent of man, this march of progress from the small archaic ape through, you know, modern humans with tools and technology and everything else. And that's been revised, especially in terms of the imagery of a straight line of human evolution. Everybody's after the direct human ancestor, what's on, you know, the direct ancestral line between us and that earliest ape. But the more fossil humans we discover, the more that we realize that we belong to this diverse bush of human evolutionary diversity, that, you know, you have multiple species of humans living on the planet at the same time. And it's really unusual now that there's only one. For the past 6 million years, there's been three or four or more species of human present on the planet at the same time. Now there's just one. And that's a relatively new understanding, given the context that we've been able to achieve from the fossil record.
And an email question.
Do you think that NASA's recent discovery of arsenic-based bacteria will have any effect on our understanding of evolution? And that's from Tom in Sydney, Australia.
Yeah, I've been following that story as it's developed. I haven't read the actual paper yet myself, so anything I say obviously has to be taken with a grain of salt. But from what I understand, it's not yet confirmed that these are arsenic-based bacteria. It seems that they use arsenic, which is really unusual and really cool in of itself. You know, this hasn't been seen before. They're a new kind of extremophile, these kind of bacteria that live in these really harsh, extreme environments. but it's not an entirely new form of life as it's been sort of proposed. It's life as we know it, using a new chemical or a different chemical in a new sort of way, but it's not something so completely alien that is going to revolutionize our understanding of evolution or what life on other planets might be like. It's certainly relevant. You know, studying extremophiles will definitely give us a sort of allow us to pick out what we might what we should look for when we look for life on other planets, and might help us understand the origin of life as we understand it. But it's not going to revolutionize things in quite the way that has been proposed in some of the newspapers.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking with science writer Brian Switek, author of Written in Stone, Evolution, the Fossil Record, and Our Place in Nature. Email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com, tweet us at Skeptical Radio, or use the question submission box on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back after this short message.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, it's an hour on medical controversy straight from the headlines. We'll talk to medical physicist Dr. Mark McKenzie about the new scanning equipment that's causing a stir at U.S. airports. How do the machines actually work, and is their radiation dangerous for frequent flyers? And Dr. Brian Goldman, the host of CBC's White Coat, Black Art, shares his expert opinion on Dr. Paolo Zamboni's liberation therapy, a treatment that claims to drastically reduce the symptoms of multiple sclerosis. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 Mountain Time, live at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm speaking with Brian Switek of the Wired Science blog, Laylaps. And am I saying that correctly?
Yes.
Ooh,
yes.
Okay. He's also the author of Written in Stone, Evolution, the Fossil Record, and Our Place in Nature. So let's talk a bit about the fossils themselves, and I am going to have a horrible time pronouncing this. Tell us about Lepidosiren?
Lepidosiren.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's...
That's two in a row. I'm very excited for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, you're on a roll.
Thank you.
That's actually not a fossil. That's a living variety of lungfish. But it was important for our understanding of fossils because it's this really strange variety of fish. You know, you go fishing or you pick up some, you know, red snapper or something at the supermarket. You look at the fins of these fish and they're all bony rays. They're these, you know, sort of spikes of bone. The membrane of the fin is sort of spread across them. In Lepidosiren, you have this eel-like fish, but inside its fins are a series of bones that are very similar to the bones in our own arms. And it was discovering that fish was the beginning of the understanding of this other group of fish that no one had recognized before, that actually have a very long fossil history, that have these sort of internal structures that are very similar to our own skeletons. And it corresponds to a lot of these the earliest tetrapods, the earliest land-dwelling vertebrates, things like Tiktaalik and Acanthostega and Ichthyostega, all these sort of amphibious creatures that, you know, lived in these ancient swamps, maybe could haul themselves out of the water a little ways, but were living at the water's edge and formed the basis of the major radiation of the first animals to, or the first vertebrates to walk on land. I shouldn't say animals because insects preceded vertebrates by you know, a number of million years. But, yeah, the discovery of Lepidosiren in South America, and there's also forms that live in Africa and Australia, sort of opened up the understanding of naturalists, that there's this other group of fish that are more similar to us in their construction than, you know, the everyday fish that you might see in a pond or the fish market.
So who was Alfred Sherwood Romer then?
Alfred Sherwood Romer was a early 20th century, mid 20th century paleontologist. He was one of the guys who really got paleontology's footing back to an evolutionary understanding that involved natural selection and adaptations. And he did a lot of his work on early vertebrates, and among them were these early tetrapods, these first terrestrial vertebrates. And based upon work that had been done during the previous century, he came up with this idea that you had these lobe fin fish, these things like Lepidosiren, that were living in these ponds, and during drought, the annual droughts during the hot summer months, these ponds would sort of dry up and the fish would have to haul themselves out and sort of crawl across the baking sand or the baking mud. And those who were able to crawl to the nearest source of water would survive. Those who couldn't would perish. And through that selective force, you got the evolution of limbs. That idea has been changed. A lot of the deposits that paleontologists and geologists thought were indicative of this harsh seasonal environment actually came from swamps that stayed wet. So rather than the first limbs evolving as a result of this major evolutionary drama, you had limbs basically evolving in the water. Limbs did not evolve on land first. There was no, you know, sort of evolutionary need that these things were striving towards. Limbs evolved, you know, in the water at the water's edge. And then once limbs evolved, these things could actually come out and walk on land. So things have changed a bit since Romer's time. But he was a major figure in paleontology for considering this problem in a way that involved natural selection and function and form married together, whereas earlier paleontologists had mostly eschewed Darwin and said, well, you know, something else must have happened. There must have been some internal driving factor or some Lamarckian force of evolution or just something else. So yeah, Romer was important in establishing paleontology as we know it now.
And we have another question.
How do paleontologists take a small bone or fragment and extrapolate the characteristics of a whole animal?
Well, that's a great question because I end up doing that just about every Tuesday and Thursday at the New Jersey State Museum. I'm working on a fossil crocodile right now that came from southern New Jersey. It's about 65 million years old. And I actually hear that question a lot is, you know, how do you tell how this thing went together? It looks like this big mess of bones together in a plaster jacket. And one way to tell is, or one way to put it back together is by looking at closely related species. In my case, crocodiles haven't changed all that much in the past 65 million years, so I can look at the bones in the field jacket in correspondence to a skeleton from a living crocodile and see where things fit. It's kind of having like the box of the puzzle to you know, check as you're putting things together to make sure that you've got it right. In other cases, if it's something that we've never seen before, it involves a certain amount of hypotheses and guesswork. I mean, there are some dinosaurs that were known from partial skeletons and nobody knew what the heck they were when they were first found. There's a group in particular called Therizinosaurs, and it's a sort of group of dinosaurs closely related to the raptors, the famous raptors of Jurassic Park, but proportioned entirely differently. They had really long necks, and they had relatively small heads, and they had beaks on the front of their mouths, and they had these long sickle claws on their arms, and just these oddly proportioned things, and nobody could figure out what they were. Some people thought they were related to the huge sauropod dinosaurs. Some people thought they were related to the raptors. Some people said they're their own sort of evolutionary group. But until we had more complete skeletons and more complete skeletons of closely related groups, we couldn't figure this out. So it's basically finding context, you know, developing the context of how things fit together. You have to, you know, once you know what grouping you're dealing with and you have enough skeletons to sort of compare one to another, you can start to put things together. But sometimes you don't have that advantage and you just have to say, I've got this bone fragment, I think it's this, but I'm not really sure. If you read through the paleontological literature, you actually see a number of papers like, you know, a new bone fragment from a theropod dinosaur from, you know, central Mongolia, and the entire report will just be on a piece of vertebra or a piece of limb bone, something that should be reported, but that we don't really know what it is yet because we have nothing good to compare it to.
We're getting a lot of questions here. Another question from the website.
In an article for Wired Online, you showed a third of extinct mammals may still be alive, especially if their extinction was due to habitat loss and not predation. I know the fossil record is pretty spotty, and as we look further into it, the record is less and less complete. However, deep in prehistory, are there examples of the same reemergence of a species after it was thought to be extinct? And that's from Al Morrison in St. Catharines, Ontario.
Yeah, there have been a few examples, mostly with invertebrates and really common fossil taxa. And there's actually a name for this. It's called Lazarus taxa. It's a species that you thought was extinct but then pops up later. So you know there's this ghost lineage between the sort of space that should be filled in. There's actually a name for taxa that people – that scientists think that they're seeing but isn't really there. We call those Elvis taxa. So I love all these cute little names that paleontologists have developed over the years. But yeah, occasionally we do find species that we thought were extinct but then show up again, or even entire groups. The famous example is the coelacanth, a cousin of Lepidosiren, this lobed fin fish found off the coast of Africa. At the time it was discovered, there was really no fossil record for them over the past 65 million years. We thought that they had gone extinct, you know, around the time that the dinosaurs did. You know, the discovery of a live one showed that they obviously survived, and you know, however small a number. And since that time, there have been a few examples of fossil coelacanths that have been found during that intervening time period. You know, we don't have as many as we would like, but they've shown up. So yeah, you do get that from time to time. I mean, we've really just barely scratched the surface on the fossil record. As much as we've understood, there's still a lot more to discover, and discovery is occurring at really an unprecedented rate. Paleontology has never been more vibrant than it is right now, so I really wouldn't be surprised if we came across more lineages in the future that you know, we thought had been entirely wiped out, but will show up again at some later date.
Well, speaking of not scratching the surface, we hardly have any time left, and I realize that we haven't asked a very important question. So what is the scientific consensus on the relationship between dinosaurs and birds at this point?
Oh, well, birds are living dinosaurs. That's been pretty well established. For a while, it was in debate, but especially since 1996, when scientists started finding the first feathered dinosaurs, definitive feathered dinosaurs from China, just there's been this wealth of evidence, and paleontologists have used everything from molecular biology through some studies of proteins that have been taken from a T-Rex femur to, you know, fossil anatomy and exquisite specimens to really beef up this idea. So I'd say it's pretty much a fact at this point that birds are living dinosaurs, that they originated from small feathered dinosaurs that lived a little bit more than 150 million years ago. And one of my favorite examples of this connection was announced last year. They found out that Tyrannosaurus rex, you know, something that's not on the direct line of ancestry to birds, but a collateral relative of the bird ancestral line, its mouth was infested with a kind of microorganism that you find in the mouths of birds today. It creates these kind of lesions in the bone, these holes in the bone that are very distinctive. You see the same thing in hawks and pigeons. So what we're finding is that rather than dinosaurs being bird-like per se, birds are very dinosaur-like. A lot of the features in terms of nesting behavior, in terms of feathers, air sacs in the skeleton, you know, now T-Rex and the microorganisms in its mouth, all these features appeared in dinosaurs first and were fairly widespread amongst dinosaurs. So really, there cannot be any reasonable doubt at this point that birds are living dinosaurs.
And that's our time. Thanks very much for being here, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
Brian is the author of Written in Stone, Evolution, the Fossil Record, and Our Place in Nature. You can find him at wired.com/wiredscience/laylaps, and that's LAELAPS. And there's also a link on this episode's show notes at skepticallyspeaking.com. And since you're there, there are also links to Facebook, to Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show and leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Hi, this is Bubba Brinkman. I have a new album called The Rap Guide to Human Nature, and one of the songs on there is about a hypothesis of human behavior called spiritualism. And I want to give you an example of where I got the idea from partially. My dad is a relatively scientific guy. He runs a tree planting company and is into biology and ecology, and botany specifically, of course, but and especially climate change science is very good on. But he has sometimes spiritual leanings, and one of the moments that made me realize this was when he phoned me first thing in the morning one day, and Richard Dawkins had just been on the radio talking about his Greatest Show on Earth book, and Dawkins was talking about the recurrent laryngeal nerve, which runs from the brain to the larynx and controls the voice, but it doesn't run directly from the brain to the throat. It runs down under the aorta of the heart, loops under it, and then comes back up to the larynx. And the reason it wastes all this space, all this nerve fiber, is because in our fish ancestors it ran much more directly from the brain to the gill, but as we evolved then our anatomy changed, our heart moved down, and the nerve could not be rerooted. It just had to grow longer and longer, so that now in mammals it's a foot and a half or so long, but in giraffes it's about 7 feet long. And it's a very strong argument against intelligent design, because it's just such stupid design, and it shows as a atavistic carryover from our evolutionary origins. But my dad heard Dawkins explain all this, and then he phoned me in the morning and he said, "Baba, I think I see a flaw in his logic. Maybe the nerve takes that route to allow people to speak from the heart." And I had one of those split moments where half of me was going, "Ah, that's so sweet," and the other half of me was going, "No, that's not how it works." But it really made me realize why people have spiritual leanings is because it's a projection of what's comfortable onto the world, what's what makes us feel better. It would be so lovely if that was the reason why the nerve takes that route, but it fails to take into account that the heart is essentially a pump and we project our emotions onto it. But it was one of those empathy / frustration moments that I think people in science feel quite a lot, and I felt it then.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking, our mind reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.